Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the February 26th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Welcome aboard as we spend the next hour talking about our nation's space program, and we'll do that today with the help of someone who has spent most of his career on the front lines of the space shuttle program, former astronaut and retired president of United Space Alliance, Mike McCulley, will be my guest today. So if you've ever wanted to ask an astronaut a question or you've got something on your mind about the space program that you'd like to share, you're invited to do so, well, in a number of ways. First, you can give us a call live here in the studio at 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. So once again, the number 321-768-1240, the number to dial in here. Of course, if you are a little shyer or whatever, prefer to send us something by email, the address we're monitoring all the time here is spacetalking@aol.com. By the way, I do want to apologize to whoever it was that called in last week and was completely ignored by yours truly. It was my first live show after my extended hospital stay last year, and I guess I wasn't paying close enough attention to the caller screen. So whoever you were, if you're out there and want to try again, please call back. I promise to do better today. Well, congratulations to the United Launch Alliance team that successfully sent an Atlas V into orbit this past Friday afternoon on board a Navy communications satellite, the first in a new series of such spacecraft. The rocket was configured with five solid rocket boosters, and boy, did it blast out of here. I mean, that thing tore out of here. There's no doubt about it. Put on a great show up and down the Space Coast. Hope you had a chance to see it. I've been telling my NASCAR fans that this is an example of real speed. Of course, I understand the race is being delayed by rain. We certainly know about what that's like down here. But anyway, it was a great reminder of that launch. Even if we don't have a space shuttle flying anymore, this country does still have a significant launch capability and that we remain active in space. It just doesn't have to be NASA to be spaceflight. Which brings us today to Orbital Inclinations, my broadcast blog now heard each week during this opening segment of Space Talk. And so here we go with today's Orbital Inclinations. Well, you gotta love sound effects. With the 50th anniversary this past week of John Glenn becoming the first American in orbit, the release of NASA's budget for 2013, and lingering thoughts about Newt Gingrich's campaign promises to put a permanent base on the moon within 8 years of him becoming president. Well, there have been plenty of fodder for commentators of all sorts to support or dump on our space program. Now, what's been a pleasant surprise to me is that in all of the events here in the last couple of weeks here have led up to a number of instances where we're finding support for NASA and our space program in general. It's been a real treat going online and reading some of these commentaries, some of which have found flaming liberal Democrats begrudgingly agreeing with Newt, and some that are almost apologetic in their tone for supporting space, like they were revealing some deep, dark family secret coming out of the closet. A few examples. This past week, the Christian Science Monitor published a column written by Congressman Eddie Johnson, who's a Texas Democrat. He wrote about supporting the space program, and this is what he said. He said, "It is about inspiring people. It is about providing a peaceful and positive demonstration to nations around the world of American technological preeminence. It is also about developing cutting-edge technologies for human space missions that benefit our citizens and create new jobs. It also motivates young people to pursue careers in science and engineering and advances knowledge generally. Well, here's a politician I can agree with. Now, a few other examples. From Manchester, New Hampshire, a columnist for the Union Leader reacted in a column about the John Glenn anniversary and saying, "There is much to be said for a nation's looking to its future as a way to inspire itself and bring on the kinds of innovation that came when Glenn, Alan Shepard, and other early astronauts blazed a trail in the heavens." More comments. This one from the Auburn Citizen in New York. A columnist talked about all the grand achievements of our space program and its many benefits, and then commenting on such things as NASA's declining budget and the fact that we have to rely on Russia to take our astronauts to the International Space Station. Despite all that, he says, now we seem to be more about what can't be done, not what challenges we can conquer. You know, there are folks out there that I think do get it. Even in faraway South Africa, a publication called the Daily Maverick gives, it gave an accurate view of the status of America's space program and then wrote, "Sadly, for those of us who were entranced by the wonder of those space missions then, NASA now has a greatly shrunken profile. The proposed Mars mission is far away, and under current budgetary constraints, maybe it is actually located in Never Never Land." Well, there's a lot of positive things being written. There's even hope from the most liberal, distrustful of authority, and cynical of all commentators, the modern college student journalist. Claire Anderson of the Massachusetts Daily Collegian took every cheap shot she could at Newt Gingrich's ideas for going back to the moon that she could muster. She ridiculed Republicans in general, Star Wars fans, even took a shot at President John F. Kennedy's hair, if you can imagine what kind of a column it was. But yet, God love her, after spending an entire column repeating time and again that a lunar colony is not only impossible, but basically a stupid idea, she finally concludes by saying, "You know what? They should at least revamp NASA, increasing the budget, and should attempt again to send people to the moon and beyond, if only to see what is out there. The U.S. government spends money on crazier ideas, so why not this?" Claire, it's not just the government that spends its money on space, which to me, of course, is not a crazy idea at all. There are other folks much closer to your age than mine who also think that spending their own money on space is a good idea. Now, I know the Space Coast isn't exactly a hotbed for hockey fans, the presence of the Space Coast Iceplex in Rockledge notwithstanding. But you know what? From the world of the NHL this past week came the news that Winnipeg Jets forward Jim Slater, apparently no relation to our local surf legend Kelly Slater, has said that he doesn't plan to get a new car or a big house with his next big contract. Instead, Jim said he would rather spend $250,000 to go into space for 30 seconds. The local paper reported that the topic came up when Slater visited a Winnipeg fire station this week and admitted he didn't want to be a fireman as a kid. His real dream while growing up in Michigan was to be an astronaut, and apparently it still is. He said, "I think it would be so cool to just go to outer space." Well, from what I've seen written about the space program during the past couple of weeks, there seems to be a strong sense that there are a lot more people out there who still think going into space is still cool. Now, if we can only convince our elected leaders to reflect that thinking in our nation's budget. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. If you'd like to add your comments, you can give us a call, 321-768-1240, or send an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Or go online to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and follow the link to Orbital Inclinations. Mike McCauley joins us in just a moment, so please do stay tuned. I'm Jim Bankey, and you're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And indeed, welcome back to Space Talk, everyone, now at its new time spot of 3 p.m. here every Sunday on WMMB. Again, reminding you, 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. Or you can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, as we welcome former astronaut and retired United Space Alliance President Mike McCulley to the program today, let's set the Wayback Machine to 1989 and briefly listen in to what was happening at the Kennedy Space Center on October 18th, more than 22 years ago.
This is Shuttle Launch Control. Liftoff of Atlantis's fifth mission into space is planned for the opening of today's launch window at 12:50 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Commander for this mission is Don Williams. The pilot is Mike McCulley.
Good morning, Houston. PLT, comm check.
Atlantis PLT, Houston, good morning. You're loud and clear. How me?
Loud and clear, Frank.
We thought you'd be higher by now.
So did I.
Three, two, one. We have ignition and liftoff of Atlantis and the Galileo spacecraft bound for Jupiter.
Houston now controlling.
That's great. Great to have you with us today, Mike McCulley.
Yeah, Lisa and Frank. That was a fun day.
That was all. Well, what are your memories of that day? What stands out still after all these years?
Well, you know, that comment I made there at the end about, or Frank said, thought we'd be higher.
Yeah.
We tried to launch the day before, and the weather was really nice, and we got in the vehicle, and we laid there for 3.5 hours. And then Bob Seek said, well, we got a thunderstorm. And my response to him was, Bob, it's blue sky from where I'm looking, which is up straight up.
Right.
You know, some little dingy thunderstorm over there by the SLF someplace.
But your friends in Houston said that was no go.
That was no go. So you get out of there, and it's hard getting out.
Yeah.
You just don't want to. So we got in the next morning, though, and it was raining, and they called us and said, look, there's very little probability of launching today, but we tanked the vehicle. You guys mind getting in?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course not. So we take our galoshes on, our boots, and we head out to the pad, lay there for another 3 hours or so, all I wanted, I didn't care about anything except the clock going to zero.
Right.
and I kept watching the clock. And, Don would remind me to take a look at the engines or do some check.
Right.
There's not a whole lot to do as long as everything is going okay. And on those real narrow window is when we added in that extra time. So you just lay there on your back. But I just wanted to go, and we did.
And you did. And a few seconds later, a few minutes later, you did what every pilot is trained to do, right? You threw the switches to start the auxiliary power units, and that was really your only duty until lowering the landing gear five days later, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, we know you, Mike, in the community as a businessman, as a leader of United Space Alliance, and sometimes we like to forget that you – well, I don't we like to forget, but we do forget that you were an astronaut, wore the blue suit. Take us back to those years in the 80s when you were flying, and what still, after all this time, stands out to you about your experience as an astronaut? What have you taken from that it's still kind of top of mind after all this time?
Well, Jim, I often, especially with audiences when I'm doing a typical astronaut talk, I always start out by saying I'm the luckiest man alive.
Yeah.
And when I think about the things that the country – the Navy, NASA has allowed me to experience and allowed me to take part in. And then also my family, Jane and the kids, I just couldn't have done all this without them. But those years in the astronaut office were special. You're with a very special group of people, not all of whom you like necessarily, but mm-hmm. they're a special group of people. The experience, the not learning all these things. The shuttle is a complicated, space is a complicated thing. It is rocket science. And even though I had a couple of engineering degrees and test pilot school behind me, there's still a tremendous amount to learn. So you're always learning in that environment. You never stop. And that's fun to be in that position. I was also fortunate in not only, of course, flying in space, but also the jobs that I had in those years, which weren't necessarily the favorite jobs, collateral duties of astronauts, like being the representative to the program requirements board. I learned so much. And so when I made that transition to Lockheed and to the launch site director at KSC, I walked in the door far more ready than many astronauts are when they leave the astronaut corps to take on the business responsibilities, because I understood a lot of the processes, and I also knew a lot of the people that I met outside of the astronaut office in the agency and in the contractor workforce.
And that experience as an astronaut, I mean, you got to be pretty something special to get picked in the first place. But as you transition those skills to the workplace and into United Space Alliance eventually, how did you pick up all the rest of the knowledge that you had learned? We were kidding. My wife and I were kidding on the way over here. She's taking online a business finance class. She's got to do one more chapter and take a test yet today. And she's having some troubles with some issues. We thought, well, maybe Mike would get you help do some finance stuff. You're president of a big company. Surely you know all this stuff. You know, as you transition from an astronaut to that other area, to that private side, the contractor side, you know, you felt you were ready. You felt like you still had a lot more to learn. Was it even as difficult as learning to become an astronaut the first time around? What was it like?
Far more intense. And I have to credit Lockheed. When I came in, not many people remember that I was the deputy as a launch site director for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
And so Lockheed brought me along in terms of my areas of responsibility in a really nice way.
Yeah.
They kept me away from money and unions for 2 or 3 years. They let me concentrate on operations and the OPFs and VAB, the pads, that sort of stuff.
Surely your expertise anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I could build, and then they would send me to these corporate classes, and some of it would deal with finance. And so, again, I have to give credit to my leaders in the Lockheed world for the 4 or 5 years that I spent as a deputy, because they, by the time my boss left and I became the launch site director, and then I became the associate program manager and all these other jobs that I had up through CEO, I felt completely ready to walk into every single one of those jobs.
And the question behind the question then is this, you know, there's always this chat in the space community about, do astronauts make good managers? And some people make good managers and some people don't. But now you add the astronaut label to it. Does that make you any more particularly right for the job of management or wrong for the job of management?
Well, the way I always viewed it when I came down here is I walked in the door with a huge amount of credibility, and it was mine to lose.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember after I'd only been here a few months, I saw 3 or 4 things that I wanted to wade into and change. And the company president and I were standing outside OPF 1 one day, and he said, well, how are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I feel like a kid on a diving board, just sort of bouncing up and down, just kind of timid about just diving in. And I remember Doug Sargent was who it was, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, you dive, and I got you covered. And a little later that day, Honeycutt was sort of my NASA counterpart, Jay Honeycutt.
Yeah,
a little later that day in a meeting, I said BS to one of his lieutenants. And before I got back to my office, he'd already been called and said, look, guess what your contractor did? So I built this confidence, and like I said, I had the credibility, and fortunately, I didn't make any really stupid moves.
I remember reporting on anyway.
Well, all of us have made mistakes, and I certainly made my share of mine, but the astronaut title and experience just gave me a credibility and an ability to communicate with people.
Yeah.
And the other thing was Lockheed in those days they had great technicians and inspectors and engineers. Their management team was a strong management team, but they didn't have anybody in the company that could truly connect the dots from operator to maintainer.
Yeah. And if we think about pre-Challenger as sort of a golden age, you know, young and innocent, and then this whole period of discovery, return to flight in 88, really through even the beginning of the construction of the space station, which I think started a whole other era of operations, you guys were doing some pretty remarkable things and trying to ramp up the flight rate pretty good too. What was that like then, I guess, is the question. What do you remember about all that? And that a sense of excitement, that a sense of what you were doing, that mission, as you carried it on to Lockheed and USA, what do you take after all those? And what can we learn from that as we move forward and start up another era?
There's nearly always a better way. And you got to be willing to try to look at least. It's so easy to say no to some young engineer with a good idea. Well, it's really easy to say, now we're going to do it the way we've always done it because we understand it. And those kids have got tremendous ideas. And I think the late, after I came down here at the end of 90 and up through Space Station until I left 7 years later and went back to Houston, Honeycutt and I and Bob Seek led a charge that said there's a better way to do it. There's always a better way to do it.
Let's say real quick, Bob Seek, launch director, Jay Honeycutt, shuttle program guy, eventually became KSC center director.
Right. And we did some very innovative things, and a lot of it was because we were willing to listen to the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Well, look, Mike, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the end of the shuttle program. We want to start taking a look forward. Okay, but everyone, for now, just stand by. We're going to pause for our usual five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break now, let you get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports, find out if that big race up north has started yet, and then we'll be back to talk more with Mike McCauley. Your call is always welcome at 321-768-1240. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk with Jim Benke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Our phone lines are open for your contributions to the conversation we're having with former astronaut and retired United Space Alliance President Mike McCauley. Give us a call at 321-768-1240. Or send an email with your questions or comments to spacetalking@aol.com. And again, joined by Mike McCauley. And, you know, Mike, as famous as you are as an astronaut and as a big-time space company honcho, we all know your real claim to fame is your wife, Jane, who you mentioned earlier, and the fact that she went to school here, in fact, right across the street from the studios at Melbourne High. And so I do have to give a shout-out to Jane and the family. How is she doing, and what's new with her these days?
She's awesome as usual.
Oh, yeah, I bet she is.
We're up to 9 grandchildren and the 6 kids, and so we've always got something going on there. And, you know, you mentioned she went to school across the street, and every day after school, her grandmother was in this little Airstream park.
Oh, really? Was she?
And she would walk over there to her grandmother's house.
Oh, that's great. Long gone now, too, of course. Hey, we're talking about shuttle program and your experience there in the kind of the previous era. Last summer, of course, the shuttle program winds down. I watched from a hospital bed. You watched it from the front lines, kind of as a bystander in this case. What was that like for you to watch that final mission unfold and where you sat and what you think about it?
I'm an optimist to a fault. Jane often accuses me of putting my head in the sand, and so the optimist side of me said, I'm really glad I had my opportunity.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's okay that programs come and go and all of them do, but it's just very disturbing to me that we park something. I mean, those last 3 flights were picture perfect flights. The processing was smooth. And my biggest concern is not so much the shutting down of the program. It's just nothing to take its place. The Russians are awesome partners. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would have been in deep trouble after Columbia without the Russians. I mean, they're dependable. They're good. But we're still sitting here with a space station, $100 billion or so, some great big number. And I just believe that it's going to be very difficult to maintain it, not necessarily that it's going to blow up or come crashing back down, but to do anything with it without a big up mass and down mass capability.
People don't understand that the shuttle was more than just carrying the people up and back and forth. That up mass we're talking about is the amount of cargo that you can carry up. And of course, we can send all sorts of cargo. We could launch another 100 Progress and send all sorts of cargo up, but you can't bring anything back.
Right.
And you have to be able to bring stuff back to make that space station fully capable of all – or fully realize all of its capabilities. So the shuttle winds up, and we don't have something to fly with it in its place. and it's going to be kind of slow around the astronaut office, you would think. What are these guys up to these days?
Well, it's a lot smaller. Yeah. I don't know what the number is now, but I know that lots of folks have moved on.
It doesn't seem like a week goes by that we don't see a news release about somebody retiring.
Mm-hmm. Moving on, and that's fine. And in the meantime, NASA's got a selection process going on, which, by the way, even though everything is shut down, last I heard there's about 7,000 applicants.
Wasn't a record number, basically?
Well, the 78 group, I'm told, was near 10,000.
A little higher, yeah.
It was almost 5,000 for my group, and we selected 17. But they're going to, if station keeps going, and as strong as we hope it will be until the 2020 time frame or so, we need some new kits. And so that process is going on now to bring some in. And again, I don't know how big the actual astronaut corps is right now, but pretty quiet, except for the space station folks.
Yeah, yeah. And there's you would think there's stuff to do. And certainly we look forward to it. We talked about, and I want to get into this whole thing. When Newt Gingrich was here in January for the campaign stop, there was a roundtable, and you participated. In fact, you were one of the first people to shout out at that thing. And there were a lot of things that came out of that that brought some real national visibility to some of the kind of the things going on in our space program. And we could hit it on a number of levels. First, I'm curious, though, from your perspective, as you sat there in that round table and all of your kind of colleagues were there, what was that experience? What did you take from that experience? How did you think that went? Not necessarily in terms of Newt's success specifically, but this whole idea of candidates coming and talking and learning from folks, you know, did the right message get sent?
No, we didn't. I don't think we did as good a job as we could have.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real tendency, starting with congressmen and senators from Florida and other places that are hit, to sort of try to make it all revolve around jobs, and it needs to revolve around a bigger picture, strategic leadership in the world. This idea of space station surviving $100 billion, and I'm making that number. I'm not quite making that number up, but
right,
it's a number like
right.
that. Having that sort of investment up there and then backing away from the most important way. I mean, the NASA guys have done a really good job of trying to get as many parts up there as they can and load it up and get to the point where they don't have to have a large up-mass, down-mass capability. But I don't know. The pessimist in me says we're going to have a hard time keeping that thing alive and well out to 2020 without a big rocket.
But the new thing, you know, everyone sat there and tried to say something without really saying anything. I mean, I didn't think that forum was quite. If you did that behind closed doors with no media, no public, I would imagine it would have went a lot differently.
Well, we thought it was going to be a little different, play out a little differently. We thought he was going to come and sit down with us and then give the big speech after he had talked to us.
Yeah.
Well, as it turned out, he gave the speech first, and so we sat there and sort of looked at each other and said, okay, what's this meeting all about?
Yeah.
Since he's already given the speech. And he asked me first, after I talked, he said, well, what did you think? And I hadn't even heard all of the speech, but I said, you know, it's a plan that's workable, and I would argue with you on a few details, which I would.
Right.
And it is workable. I mean, you know, Kennedy said go to the moon back this decade, and Newt said sort of the same thing.
Right.
You know, in 8 years, let's go build a colony. Well, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, we could do that. Why can't we do it now?
Well, and they talked about, well, and here's what I found interesting there. Newt talked a lot about, well, how can we do things faster? You know, we went from Alan Shepard in 15 minutes in 1961 to a massive launch complex, the biggest rocket, you know, that's ever successfully sent something into orbit, and landing men on the moon and back 8 years, and now we are still sitting here on the ground, shuttle's done, and we're still how many years away from flying something? We can't make things go that fast anymore. And he's saying, we got to make things faster. What can we do to cut through the red tape? And I got the sense that, I don't know necessarily you, but certainly from that panel, that these guys either don't know how to do it, don't want to do it, or that some of the safety that's built into the system you really can't take away. So how do you build that rocket fast and keep it safe and cut through the red tape?
Those guys in the late 50s, early 60s, in through the 72 time frame, were willing to take risks. We are a very risk-averse group.
Yeah.
I was sitting with John Young in a meeting in Houston maybe 6 or 7 years ago, And I don't even remember what the issue we were working on to try to resolve. But John leaned over to me and said, these guys can't get to the moon.
Yeah.
Because they're just unwilling to take the risk.
And is that a cover your butt thing? Is that Congress? Is that the public perception? Is that the media ready to jump on you?
Well, this is another personal opinion. Having spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. in the last few years, Washington, this is as blunt as I can make it. They were scared to death of another accident. Mm-hmm. So when you went to them and you tried to talk about, look, you can't get rid of shuttle. Let's fly one a year just out through there. So at least you got the capability to go back and forth. And you couldn't get any traction with the senators, the House of Representatives, or their staff, which was even more important in some cases. And this, again, is my opinion and maybe mine only, but they were so afraid of it, there was no way. They couldn't wait to shut it down.
Well, and this is where it gets into the whole private enterprise thing, and this is why I think the commercial thing is something special. I understand there's still got to be a lot of government oversight and insight into what these commercial guys are doing, but if you can get someone to work outside that realm and go do things and take the risks that our government's not willing to take, isn't that the way to do business in the future?
Well, you say business, and you mentioned your wife Dawn's taking this business finance class. Yeah. Well, you know, the business is a profit and loss center, and at some point, I mean, right now it's mostly government dollars, although bless Elon Musk's heart, he's put a lot of his own money into SpaceX. But still, where's the market?
Yeah.
And so if you don't have the market, then who's going to go do this stuff? And I mean, I hope they succeed. Orbital, where Frank Culberson is now, by the way, the Capcom I was talking to a few minutes ago, he's running the human spaceflight programs, I think, at Orbital. And I really hope these guys, one or more of them, succeed in this stuff.
Can the government be the customer? I mean, so the money is still coming from the government, I get that, but if they can get out of the way of the operations, when I say doing business, I mean operations, if they can get out of the way of the operations, can we make something? Isn't there enough out there to do? Isn't there some dreams out there of money to be made that if we can just solve this problem of getting to orbit, make it cheaper, we can do something neat?
We've always had that hope that in station and before that on things like Space Lab that one of these experiments would just click and would provide the magic or the elixir or the solution to some unsolvable problem. We've gone through it with medicines and whether or not we could make medicines that would work better, a number of other things. And while there's been wonderful spinoffs, there hasn't been that one yet that says, hey, we can make money doing this. Like the Japanese are going to go to the moon and mine helium and somehow get it back because the Earth is running out of helium.
Yeah, well, and helium-3 might do something for fusion, but we don't know how to do fusion yet. So, yeah. I look forward to the space station coming back with this vaccination against MRSA, which is something I had a personal introduction to when I was in the hospital last year. So, hey, stand by, Mike. We're going to take our final break of the day. We'll have some more conversation with Mike McCauley. Plus, we're going to take a look at the local launch forecast, what's been flying around the world. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Jim now, 768-1240.
Well, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. Again, my guest, former astronaut, retired. You know, I was going to be careful when I say former USA president or former president of USA. You got to say United Space Alliance, right? Mike McCauley with us in the studio today. But first, before we get on with that conversation, let's get you caught up to date with what's been going on in space this week. Take a look at the local launch forecast now that we've had the Atlas V shot this past Friday. Remind you again, things are flying all over the place. Friday afternoon, or I guess it was Friday morning our time, China launched another Long March 3C rocket, carrying the 11th in a series of what mounts to their navigation system. We have GPS, and China now has Compass. The system was demonstrated successfully last December, and now they've launched this next satellite to make that thing operational. So we've got GPS, China's got Compass, and as we've been kind of hinting at, a lot more to come. Upcoming launches around the world, well, there's stuff flying in Europe, Russia, Japan, India, and even a Delta IV launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They're all on the books for the month of March. We'll see how many of those actually fly. Turns out then that the next launch from the Space Coast is, in fact, another Atlas V rocket targeted to fly from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. The mission now set for April 27th. The launch window, nice time in the afternoon, 3:08 to 5:08 Eastern Daylight Time, I should add. We'll be in daylight savings time by then. The United Launch Alliance shot to carry another military communications satellite, this one known as the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellite. And Mike McCulley, as we talk about the Atlas V rocket, a lot of attention on that booster and sitting there as a former astronaut. Are you ready to take a ride on that thing? And if you're not, what needs to be done to make you take a ride on that thing?
Well, the answer is absolutely. Of course, you got to have some way to breathe and go to the bathroom and do a few other things in the space capsule. But I've always been kind of amused by this idea that somehow the other human space flight was more rigorous than non-human. Those guys are no less interested in mission success than anybody in the human spaceflight business. That rocket, I just finished a book, Atlas book, that was published in 1960.
You finished reading a book?
Finished reading a book.
All right.
Yes, I'm sorry. Reading a book about Atlas that was written in 1960.
Yeah.
And it talks about the seven astronauts, but they hadn't even gone to the first flight yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fascinating book. And so here we are 50 years later with Atlases still strong and still going. One of the more interesting things I ever did in my astronaut career was serve on an accident board for Atlas Centaur 67.
Oh, yeah.
Which
was
a lightning strike shortly after liftoff. And that was just eye-opening for me to do that investigation. I think that rocket's a great rocket.
Yeah.
And it's got a tremendous success story. ULA is doing a great job managing both of those rocket systems, and I'd be more than happy to fly that rocket.
What still needs to be done, though? Is it all about redundancy and insight into the rocket system so that the commander on board can push the abort button? Do you need to do to that rocket?
Well, you have to have an abort system of some kind. But, you know, we've been there and done that before. We've had abort systems. You've got to figure out some way. If it turns out to be Orion that's sitting on the front of it, you obviously have to have some interface and integration items going in there.
But isn't that just, quote-unquote, just a payload issue?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to rewire the booster. You don't have to get new tanks or a stronger engine or whatever.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Were you here back in time to see that Atlas V fly?
Yeah.
Did you see how it vaulted off the launch pad?
It was awesome. It was a beautiful launch. It's a beautiful rocket.
Can you sit on top of that? What's your G-forces?
Oh, you can get a lot higher than what the shuttle has. I remember reading, I think it was the Gemini guys had 5 G's at staging.
Yeah.
Which was 4 G's more than we had.
Yeah.
3 G's.
You had it easy in shuttle compared to those early guys.
And
compared
to a catapult launch off of an aircraft carrier.
Well, there you go,
cake.
Too.
Yeah, you know, you're up around 10, 12, maybe 15 G's depending on the weight and wind.
Oh, geez. Well, so the Atlas V is out there. Why not the Delta IV? Why not something else? Why is it that in generally the industry is looking at Atlas V and that's where all the buzz is?
I'm not an expert on those two systems, both of which are strong and good. I know that the payload that this last Friday was the largest payload ever on an Atlas, and that nose cone or that payload fairing thing was huge.
Yeah.
I think it may be a capability or capacity issue between the two.
Well, and so you talk about capability. We still need to be able to loft giant cargo into orbit if we want to go anywhere, you know. Do we need to launch a bunch of Atlas Vs and dock everything together and then go off to the moon?
Now, I think we still need a big rocket.
And is SLS, the Space Launch System, as it's called, the answer? It's got a lot of old shuttle parts on it.
I know it does, but every year or two we change administrations, and then we change names and change programs and waste a tremendous amount of time and money in that process.
Yeah.
But just pick something and go, and maybe Charlie's done that now, Charlie Bolden, and maybe we'll get there. But we need a big rocket.
We need a big rocket.
Yep,
yeah.
Sure do.
And I want to see it fly. I've never saw Saturn V. I want to see this thing. What's next for you, Mike? I got excited when you said you'd finished a book. Do we have a Mike McCulley biography or some kind of space book from you coming anytime soon?
You know, I've actually sat down a couple of times and more than a couple and tried to do an outline. I've went online. There's actually, I'm a member of ARP, of course, at age almost 70 now.
Yeah.
I found a little area.
I got to join this year too, by the way.
Okay, good. Well, I found a area on the website for ARP talks about how you write your memoirs.
Oh, geez.
So I've read that, and I've actually been reading some memoirs and trying to get a thought process going about how. But essentially, I'm lazy, and I haven't done nearly as much as I thought I might have done by this point.
We'll talk after the program. But, you know, the challenge in you guys writing, you guys meaning astronauts, yeah, I think you got to find something fresh. You got to find some fresh approach because some of these stories have been told over and over again, and you got to find those new stories. Real quick, I got to wrap up here in a minute. Still working with the Astronauts Memorial Foundation?
You know, I just retired as the chairman of the board of the Astronaut Memorial Foundation. John McBride replaced me.
Oh, good.
At the 1st of January. I'm still active as the past chairman, and I'm actually serving on a couple of committees right now. But I'm winding down somewhat on that. I had 6 great years in that foundation, including the last 2 as chairman of the board, and I really and really enjoyed it.
We're going to see Dr. Feldman retire here and a new guy coming on board.
July.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to miss Steve, but looking forward to seeing who comes on.
Yeah, we're working that.
I understand you are. Well, Mike, thanks so much. You're a good friend for years and years. I really do appreciate your taking your time to come on down here. And, again, hugs and love to Jane and the family, okay? As we wrap up, I want to remind you that there are still many ways for you to interact with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. And if you are a user of Twitter, our hashtag is Space Talking. Again, our inbox at spacetalking@aol.com, always open for you. And for one-stop shopping for all of the above, you can just point your web browser to WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk, where you'll also find, eventually, a podcast of today's program under the on-demand section. You can download a recording of Mike McCauley and hold it against him for the rest of his life. Also on the Space Talk page at WMMB, you can find links and read and respond to this week's Orbital Inclinations, as well as there is now an archive of available Space Talk broadcasts going back to 2009. Next week on the program, we're going to talk about planets around other stars that are being discovered by NASA's Kepler telescope with the help of the mission's principal science investigator, William Baraki. Join us 1 week from today at 3 p.m. That's all for now. Space Talk, a production of Milo Solutions. My thanks to George operating the op station today. Stay tuned to WMMB now as the Best of Bill and Mick is presented. I'm Jim Banky. We'll see you again real soon.